Our speaker tonight, our scheduled speaker tonight, was Tom F. from Baltimore, and for some reason he decided not to come up due to the weather. So as a stand-in, I'd like to please help me welcome Jeff W.'s home group is Feet First.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I talked to Tom tonight, and he really wanted to come up, but he wasn't really sure on the weather. And he's driving away from Baltimore, and the storm was supposed to be much worse south of Philly, so he kind of was like, yeah, he didn't really want to. And he's getting up there in age, so I can see why he wouldn't want to drive all the way in the storm. We just had a similar experience on our little road trip. Some of us know we had a little experience, too, where we were down south and tried to come back and stuck on the ice and all that fun stuff. So I can definitely relate to his not wanting to come up tonight. I had no idea that I was going to be up here tonight at all. About 6 o'clock tonight, I found out. And the group members said we couldn't, you know, talking about getting a speaker for tonight. And a group member just said, well, just make sure you wear a tie tonight. So here I am. I brought my tie with me, and so here I am. It is absolute privilege and an honor to be standing up here tonight. When I first came in to AA around 2000, I would have absolutely told you that this would have been the biggest pain in the ass, and just would not have wanted anything to do with standing up here. And I didn't really think I had anything to offer anybody. Really, I didn't really have a purpose. You know, my purpose was coming here to get what I wanted, and that never happened. but I'll go into that in a little more detail. But it's absolute honor and privilege to be standing up here. And my name is Jeff. I'm alcoholic, just in case. I think I forgot that. My sobriety date's August 29th, 2007. I had a few other sobriety dates earlier, but they didn't work out. So I got a new one in 2007. And this one seemed to work out, as far as I know, so far. So I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. Yeah, I have a home group, which is this group. Love this group. Some awesome people here. I can tell you this: the first night I came here, I just felt at home. I knew I was at home, and got a sponsor. Didn't know who that sponsor was going to be, but I got a sponsor. And didn't really think that this was going to work this time around. It was kind of a fluke, really, how I met the person. At this point in my life, I believe God put that person in my life, but at that time, I just was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, here's this dude. Okay, whatever. He wants me to do some stuff. I'll try. It's probably not going to work, but I'll try. I can go back, you know, I can tell you this much, that for a long time, I kind of debated on the whole whether I was alcoholic or not in my mind. I thought it was directly tied to how much I drank, you know, how many times I blacked out, you know, all those things that are kind of thrown around in the rooms. And I somehow always managed to disqualify myself. It's like, nah, I'm not really alcoholic. I don't drink in the morning. You know, I don't wake up in the gutter. I still have a house to live in. You know, I didn't really lose my job. But what I came to realize is that it had very little to do with that, more with the internal feeling that I had, and that I always felt the separation from everything and everyone around me. And I used a lot of things in my life to try to fill that hole up and try to feel connected, and none of them ever really worked. Nothing external that I could ever get really would work. And I tried a lot of things, you know. I can remember, for me, my thinking is this, is that when I was a little kid, I was restless, irritable, discontented from day one. Day one. My first memories are just not fitting in, not being a part of anything, you know. My family loved me. I had a really great family. They loved me a lot. They did. They were middle class, and my mom and dad did not drink, they didn't smoke, they didn't do drugs. They were like at church every Sunday, and they absolutely did not, they didn't drink at all. So that was another theory I had, was the whole, you know, genetic alcohol thing. And I was like, oh, see, my parents don't drink, so I can't be genetic. So I kind of, again, used a lot of things to disqualify myself. But I always, you know, they loved me a lot, and you know, they did everything they could for me, and it never was enough. Never. Never. I can remember, you know, I can remember being selfish and self-centered probably from, like I said, from day one, and because of that selfishness and self-centered, I always had these expectations that I put on the world, and along with those expectations came a lot of fear. A lot of fear. I can remember that was like probably one of the first real feelings that I felt, especially when I was with my peers. When I was around all you, my friends, school, fear. I can remember my first days in school, I had to wear glasses. I had really bad eyes, and I did not want to wear glasses at all. And they used to make me sit up in the front of the class. Hated that too. But I used to get these like panic attacks in school. And like from first grade on, all the way up till about fifth or sixth grade, I used to just get these panic attacks, just like this overbearing fear. And the more I felt that fear coming on, the worse it would get, and I would start crying in the middle of class. And I'd be sitting at my desk, and I would just start crying. And my friends would be like, "Jeff's got some kind of issue going on over there," and I'd be like, "No, I'm all right, man, I'm all right." And you know, I wasn't all right. I was totally just, I was just crippled with like panic. You don't know, like just fear, you know. I can always remember, like, whenever I had friends, it was always like, I always had this idea that I needed to be what I thought they wanted me to be in order to be accepted, to get that approval. And I needed that, man. I needed that approval. I needed people to like me, and because I really had a tough time liking myself. So like any friend I had, like if my friend was like a lower class kid, I wanted to be lower class. We were too rich. If my friend of the week or of the day was, you know, had a lot, was well off, I wanted to be well off. It's like everything I had just wasn't right. You know, and I didn't know why. I just knew it wasn't right. And I had this underlying fear that you were going to find out that I just was this big fraud, you know, that I was just going to, that one person was going to stand up and be like, "Dude, you're not who you think you are, you're not who you say you are," and everybody was going to find that out. And I tried really, really hard, man, tried really hard to be whatever I thought you wanted me to be. So needless to say, as far as what my identity was, I didn't know who I was. I really didn't. I had no clue. At an early age, I had some incidents happen in my neighborhood. Some older kids did some stuff that got me involved in some situations of a physical nature that a little kid who's 7 years old shouldn't really have to go through, but it happened. And for a long time, I thought that's why I drank. I blame that totally. You know, I blame the fact that I was abused as a kid. It's like, no, that's why I drink. That's why I drink, man. So just leave me alone. I'm all right because it's not my fault, and this is why I'm doing what I do. I've come to realize my perception on that has changed too. Again, I was restless, irritable, discontent long before that happened. And I was a self-seeking, selfish little kid. And these people would like take me and put me on this little pedestal, and I would gladly jump right up there. Every time, I would gladly jump up there and be like, "Okay, yeah, you can hold me at the center of your world. I like it there. I liked it there." felt good. It was gratifying, you know, physically, emotionally, and on some level spiritually. I was a sinner. I was like omnipotent, you know. Problem is, I can't stay there. And every one of those people, after however long we would do what we did, they would say, okay, later. Don't tell anybody. We're out of here. And I learned early on that relying on humans for that feeling was a dicey game. Problem is, I kept trying to do it. And go figure. I just kept trying. Like, just, you know, it's like the utter inability to just leave it alone, no matter how great the wish or desire. But anyway, so I learned early on that people were pretty much tough to rely on and depend on. Like I said, I still tried for a long time. Then I found this thing called alcohol. And alcohol was just so dependable for me. It was, you know what, if I had alcohol and other substances that I used, man, they never told me no. Never. They never walked out. They never said, no, you know what, I got some other stuff I'm going to do tonight. You're on your own. They always did what I wanted to do. They always brought about that feeling that was this relief from this fear that I didn't fit in. I always felt like this. It's like they talk about in the third step prayer, you know, relieve me from bondage of self. Alcohol did that, man. It relieved me from the bondage of me. And I could, like, talk to people, and I could, like, I could be this other person, whatever it was, without that fear. So that's what I did. I used alcohol a long time to kind of numb that fear that I always felt, and walking, getting up in the morning, and, you know, going to school and doing what I had to do and hanging out with friends. It became a lot easier. As I was going up in high school, I had a lot of other issues going on. But I always had that underlying thought of I just needed to be accepted, man, and I would do anything. I'd meet parents of my friends, and I would just be like the super polite, like, perfect little kid. And all the parents were like, man, you're such a great kid. And I'm like, yeah, I am. I am a good kid, ain't I? It was all an act, but, you know, I was a good manipulator. You know, I was a good manipulator. As I got older, I used alcohol a lot more and a lot of other drugs, again, like I said. Relationships were always a difficult thing for me, personal relationships with other people. I tended to use alcohol to make those relationships work, because again, it was always something I always wanted. It was like society was bombarding me with this thought that I needed to find this certain person that was just gonna make my world perfect, and if I could just find that one person, everything would be great. And I searched long and hard. I got to say this too, to go back a little bit. When I was, because this directly relates to what I'm going to talk about later. This whole God thing. Like I was telling you, my parents went to church every Sunday. Matter of fact, we lived two houses up from where our church was. We used to walk there every Sunday, right down the house. We would, like, pass one house, church. I was a little kid, and I was going to church. I was doing my thing, you know. I was, like, showing up. I was singing in the choir. I was doing all stuff, youth group. You know, I was, like, being a good little church-going person, and meanwhile, I was having these experiences with these other people when I was a very young age, and I knew in my heart that what I was doing with these guys was wrong in my mind at that point. And but I knew on some levels I liked the feeling that it gave me when I was with them. The problem was, is that when I was at church, what I heard was people who do those things, God doesn't really like you all that much. And that was the message I got. Now, I don't know if that's what they were telling me, but that's what I heard as a little 7-year-old brain. That was my perception at the time, was that people who do those things, yeah, God's going to punish you. And I'm thinking, and on the same terms of that, I'm hearing this like, but God is responsible for everything. You know, God gives you everything. You know, and I'm like, okay, well, wait, he gave me this thing, but then he's going to punish me for it. Okay, I just couldn't comprehend that, and I immediately, my brain went to, okay, yeah, this God of yours is a big freaking hypocrite. It's a big hypocrite. And I don't know who would want any part of that God to give me this horrible thing and then tell me that down the line I'm going to pretty much go to hell for it. And so at that point, even at an early age, man, God was just out the door. Out the door. So I thought. I really did not want anything to do with your God or their God or anybody else's God. I was like, no, I'm totally cool by myself doing my thing. So at that point, like I said, God was out of my life pretty early. To get back to the relationship thing, man, relationships became my higher power. You know, I'd meet somebody and they'd come into my life and I liked them, they liked me, and as long as we were together, man, everything was perfect. You know, I could like the stars were aligned and everything was good. And most of those relationships revolved around alcohol. Almost everyone. They revolved around alcohol or drugs. I used to those things, man, for a long time. And the problem was is that I could never, none of those things ever filled that hole. None of them. I always still felt empty majority of the time. As soon as I wasn't directly in, as soon as I wasn't held directly at the center of that person's world, my world crumbled. And alcohol was the only thing that gave me any relief from it. And the problem was is that at this point I'm getting a little older and alcohol's starting to deal with some consequences. You know, I got a DUI, I wasn't even of age. Got arrested many times for controlled substances and underage drinking and fighting and all this stuff and in my mind all I learned was, man, you got to do this better. Don't get caught, man. Jeez, you know, just don't get caught. And I got pretty good at not getting caught. I spent a good run, man, without being in the back of a police car. For a long time, man. But I still always had that underlying relationship thing going, man. I used alcohol not only to give myself relief, but this is like some of the things I would do. I'd meet this person, and then I like had this thought in my head that okay, I'm like, if I get drunk enough, man, my inhibitions get lowered. And I'm like, well, so I'm pretty sure that if I get you drunk enough, that you're going to lower your inhibitions. And then once that happens, I can get what I want from you. And I did that a lot of times to some pretty detrimental consequences that I paid. You know, friendships lost. A lot of running away. I did a lot of running away from those things. But the one thing I never ran from was the booze. Because it was always dependable. It was like my buddy. It's like my best friend. You know, never let me down. Never let me down. Well, at least at that point it didn't. I started getting this perception. Started having these ideas. As I grew up, again, I had problems with relationships, and I tended to put myself in these relationships where I was a victim role, and I'd get involved with all these people who would. They'd give me this little bit of themselves, but then they would always be involved or married or have a significant other, and they'd always like be like, yeah, this is cool, I really like being with you, but once we're done with this, I'm going to go back to my normal, regular thing. And what happened was, all my relationships were like that, all of them. And what I started to think was that everybody was like that. I started thinking that every single person that's married cheats on their spouse. That was my perception. That's not how it is, but that's the way I perceived the world, was that everybody who's married cheats. And needless to say that I started getting this idea of the way I perceive society as pretty much a negative thing. Wasn't able to trust people, didn't believe anything people said. They're like, yeah, okay, yeah, you're lying. You're really just trying to get your little bit out of the world, every little bit you can, and at everybody else's expense. And I didn't realize I was doing the same thing. You know, I didn't realize that everything I did, every time I tried to like help somebody or like be generous to somebody or like try to give something to somebody or like do something for somebody, everything revolved around what could I get from them. Everything. It was like this this selfishness pervaded my life, and I didn't even know it. I wasn't even aware. So I started having this real tough time with this one person, and I started getting real depressed. And I work with my parents. They have a family business. And then I started showing up at work, except the drugs and alcohol weren't giving me any relief at this point, and I was really, really depressed because this person wasn't also doing what I wanted them to do. Go figure. And I got really depressed, and so I did what most people do. I went to the doctor, and I told them, and they said, okay, well, you need to check into a mental institution. And I did that, and I spent some time, and it was right around the year 2000, and they, right about the time they started getting politically correct and started calling them behavioral health. It sounded so much cleaner than the mental institution, but it was a psych ward, basically. And I found myself there, and immediately put me on a bunch of different medications, immediately. That's what they do. And they just trying to help me, you know. Don't hold anything against them, they were just trying to help. But they had me on all these psych meds, and I was like, okay, yeah, this is the solution. Okay, I found it now. These will help me. These will make everything okay. I was on Prozac for a while, and that worked for a little while. And I wasn't depressed anymore. But I was just irritated and angry at everything and everyone. So I was like, yeah, I'm not depressed, but I hate you, and I want to kill you and get out of my face before I do just that. So I went back to this. To my psychiatrist, and of course, you know, they do what any good psychiatrist does, is they prescribe something else. It's Klonopin. They'll take this. Well, Klonopin, right on the bottle, it's got that bright orange sticker that says alcohol may intensify this effect. And I was like, well, that's definitely directions for me to use alcohol with it, you know. That's like what I need to do. If that works as it is, and that alcohol intensifies it, well, then it's going to work even that much better. So I did that. And it was this constant up and down of this, like, drinking, taking an antidepressant, but yet drinking a depressant, and taking Klonopin, and just, like, needless to say, I was just squirrely all over. I still had no solution, and I still kept trying to do the relationship thing, and this, you know, the person I was with, if they wanted to be sober, I wanted to be sober. If they wanted to drink, I wanted to drink. It was, like, had nothing to do with me. It was all just me trying to get this person in a position where I could, where they would keep me at the center of their world. That was it. Whatever I had to do to be at the center of their world, was I was willing. I was willing to pay the price. Definitely willing. So it got a little. So this person was out of my life again, and I found myself super depressed. And Prozac and Paxil and all those other things weren't working. Remeron, Effexor. I mean, I could go down the whole list of all the ones I tried. They weren't working anymore, and I was really depressed again, and I was drinking, like, way more than I was before, and drink wasn't working again, and I'm, like, still depressed, and I'm, like, going out to bars, drinking, and just smoking, and I'm, like, okay, what, this is not working anymore. Why isn't this doing what it's supposed to be doing? So even at that point, alcohol kind of wasn't even dependable for me. So I did what I thought I needed to do, and that was I went to a rehab. Because I was like, okay, well, if I could just get this alcohol and drug thing out of my life, man,
then I'll be able to find the relationship. Then I'll be able to find the job. I'll be able to get all these things that alcohol was no doubt getting in the way of. That's why I can't find what I want, because alcohol. So I went there, and they really tried to help me. They really did. They did the best they knew how to do. And I spent about 9 days in a rehab up in Allenwood, Pennsylvania, called White Deer Run, in the dual diagnosis unit. Johnny talked about it a little bit last week. I was in the same room, same house. I went to my first AA meeting actually there. And I could really relate. You know, I remember the one guy came in and he was like, had his little pad and he was talking about all slogans and he's like reading, you know, like he's just like flipping, he's a slogan guy. He's like, oh yeah, you know, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, and you know, and this one's really good, you know. And he's like going down the line with these slogans. I'm like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I could see like the wisdom in it. But I didn't know why. I was just like, yeah, okay, yeah. Cotton. Ears. Mouth. Okay. And so I got out of there, and a friend of mine's stepdad, I grew up with these three brothers. One was actually a little older than me, one was a little younger, and then one was younger yet. And I had known them all my life through school. Well, their stepfather was in the program for a long, long time. At that time, he probably had about 20 years. And he called me out of the blue. Imagine that. I got out of rehab, and like the next day, he called me. He's like, hey, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, I don't know why. He's like, oh, meeting. Go on, come to a meeting with me. Like, you know, little did I didn't know. I didn't know the deal, what we do here at the time. So I was just like, oh, that's so nice of him. Ask me to go to a meeting. What a great guy. And so I went to this meeting, and he gave me this big book, and he wrote in it, you know, good luck, love Bill, put the date, first meeting. He wrote that first meeting. I was like, oh, dude, that's so cute. You know, so, like, that was my thought. I was like, wow, that's so adorable. You know, never read it. Never read the book. Didn't read it. Had it. You know, didn't read it. I went to meetings for a while. Just didn't drink. That was my intention. That's what rehab told me. Just don't drink. Everything will get better. Just hang out, man. Miracle, rub off. You wait. It will. I'm like, okay, cool. When? Because I'm like, really need it now. Like, not like a year, 10 years from now. Now. Like, when? Today? Every time I go to meet, I'm like, okay, maybe today. Maybe today. Maybe today. And it never did. Never did. And I got pretty uncomfortable. And another relationship with the same person cropped up again, and out the door I went. It's like, okay, yeah, well, that didn't work real well, so maybe this will work this time. And I went back out and spent another couple months out partying with this person and just wreaking all kinds of havoc, throwing computer screens through car windows, and just craziness. Insanity. Fighting outside. We're in Maine up at this mall, and like I'm like buying this person everything they want, and we're like two sober people, and I'm like just buying this person everything they want, thinking that that's what's gonna like make them see how great of a person I am and how much they need to be with me. And eventually it, you know, wore on this person's self-esteem that you know, I'm like doing all this stuff to them. And we ended up getting in this huge fight outside of this mall. And we're like rolling around on the ground. Like people were walking by with their bags, like looking at us like, what are those two guys doing? And I'm like the whole time I'm going, dude, I'm like, chill, man. The cops are going to be here. So it was like the perfect alcoholic relationship, you know. But, like, you know, 20 minutes later, we're all like best friends again. You know, everything's okay. It was just one of those things that happened, you know. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, it's just one of those things. It happens to everybody, doesn't it? That night, that person decided they wanted to drink, and I was like, yeah, sure, it's a good idea, after what happened today, man, we need to be drinking, man. And you know, again, it was like, whatever that person wanted, that's what I did. And so I went back out and I drank, and then Spent another 3-4 years drinking and partying. And that person had subsequently left out of my life. And I went back to the only other thing that I knew how to do, which was just countless physical relationships that just were like over and over and over and over again, a different face every time, a different person. I didn't know their names half the time. It was just a different person, just me getting what I wanted from them, and then they were gone. And again, most of those people that I was getting involved with were also married or had spouses or had significant others, and again, I got back into that thought of, man, this the world is just crap, man. Why would anybody want to be a part of this? Why would anybody want to be a part of this world, man, when everybody's just lying and cheating and just getting what they wanted? And I got pretty desperate. Suffice to say, I got to the point where I had gotten a ticket for no registration on my truck. There was like a mix-up, and it wasn't anything intentional. It was just like a mix-up on this new truck I got, and I got pulled over. I got a ticket for no registration. And I was there paying a ticket, and I had a lot of hostility towards humanity at this point. And I'm like standing in line to pay this little window where I pay my ticket, you know. And there was this rack, and there was a meeting list on there. And I picked it up, and I don't even know why. Now I probably was like God going, dude, pick that up. So I pick it up, and I'm like reading it, and it says, every alcoholic gets to a point in their life where they can't imagine their life with the drink or without the drink. And they're at the jumping off point. And I was like, oh man, like that is me. I am at the jumping off point. And I was like, and this is my thing. This is my thinking was, yeah, I'm at the jumping off point. And if you're close to me, I'm pulling you over with me. You're coming with me, man. I'm not going alone. So I knew that. That was like a little glimmer of what I kind of needed to do. That week was like probably the toughest week of my life, in that I was getting up and going to work, and I'm going to work every day, and my thinking is like this: you should all just fucking die. Excuse my language. You should all just F and die. Everyone here. I don't care if I love you. I don't care. Just humans suck. You all just suck. One night I'm sitting in my room about a week after I saw that jumping off point thing, and there was a new show on. It was like 60 Minutes, and they were talking about this kid, this troubled young guy who went into a college and he shot a bunch of people and took his own life. And what they were doing is this is a year anniversary of that incident. And what they were doing is they were reading his journals. They were reading what this young, troubled guy had written prior to what he did. And I just sat there, because they were my thoughts, literally. What that kid wrote down was exactly what I was thinking in my head. And I believe that God uses everything in our lives. Today, I believe that God uses everything. Even the most horrible, tragic things has a positive aspect if you can be open-minded enough to see it. And that night, that incident was a catalyst for me the next day calling this guy who had brought me to my first meeting. And I called him. I said, Bill, I said, I need help, man. I am in some serious trouble. I said, I can't live like that. I didn't want to die. I really didn't. But I just absolutely, positively did not want to live the way I was living. I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. And alcohol wasn't working at this point. Nothing was working. People weren't working, obviously. I hated everyone and hated all you guys. And I was like, you know what? I just didn't know what to do. And I knew this guy was a pretty happy guy. So I went to him. And he sat down. I remember this. He sat down on his deck. And I looked like crap. And I wasn't smiling, and I wasn't happy, and I was like, my thoughts were, you know, his wife made dinner, and we're out there talking, and he's like, so, it's Wednesday night, are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, well, there's a meeting you can go to if you want. And my thought went like this. Oh, jeez. Freaking AA again. I'm like, God, all right. I'm like, back to the sentence. Back to my jail sentence of a boring, boring life of sobriety. Okay. Oh, yeah. I show up at these damn meetings all the time. And so I went to this meeting. And again, I wasn't smiling. I wasn't happy. And no doubt wasn't joyous, and I wasn't free. I started going to these meetings, and I went back to the same old thing of, you know, just don't drink, go to a meeting. Don't drink, go to a meeting. Just don't drink, go to a meeting. Get your ass to a meeting. If your ass falls off, put it in a wheelbarrow, you know, the whole thing, you know, everything that I heard. And I'm like, okay, well, I have a lot of wheelbarrows, so that's good, because I'm a landscaper. I'm like, I got wheelbarrows, man. So I'm like, then I'm thinking, well, who's going to freaking push the wheelbarrow? My ass, if I'm in the wheelbarrow, who's going to push it, you know? So I started going to these meetings. I met some friends that I had grown up with, and you know, their intentions were well. They had great intentions. They really, really just wanted to help me the only way they knew how. A friend of mine was out from York, one of the brothers that I talked about, and he was just like, he was like so enthusiastic about this recovery thing. I had met him on that Friday. I went in my meeting that time, this time around. I went in on Wednesday, and that Friday night I met this kid who was back visiting his family over Labor Day. And he was like so enthusiastic. I couldn't get past that. And it was actually kind of annoying, really, to be honest with you. He was really annoying. And he just kept saying, he's like, dude, don't drink and go to meetings. That's bullshit. That's bullshit, man. You got it. There's a whole other message they're not telling you here. And I'm like, yeah, okay, dude. Yeah. Yeah, whatever. And he's like, no, dude, you got to come out and hear my sponsor Saturday night at this meeting. My sponsor's speaking at this meeting. You got to come out and see it. Can't come out and hear what he has to say. I'm like, yeah, okay, dude, whatever. And he's like, no, dude, come on. Are you going to come with me? I'm like, all right, if I come with you, will you just shut up? I'll go with you. All right, I'll just go with you. Little did I know that God was using that person without my permission, without his permission, and didn't know it then, but I'm conscious of that now, that God has definitely put that person in my life. I went to that meeting that night, and I heard this guy share from the podium that I'd never heard anybody share about these steps and about this big book. And he shared about how his dad was like so overcome with just amazement of how it changed his son that his dad like wanted this big book. And I'm like, God, dude, I have one of those. I have one of those books, man. So, and then that night, I happened to meet my sponsor. And I really didn't want to go up and talk to him, but this annoying, enthusiastic person wouldn't let me get by it. And he's like, dude, just go talk to him. Go talk to him. Go talk to him. I'm like, all right, dude, I'll go talk to him. Just relax. I'll go talk to him. So I did, and I remember in the kitchen that night at Sellersville, and I walked up to this person and I asked him for help and said, can you help me? And he's like, well, you know, you're pretty far away if you're from York. I don't know if he remembers this or not, but he said, you're from York. You just stay out there with those guys and you'll meet somebody. And I was like, dude, I'm not from York. He's like, well, where do you live? I go, well, you ever hear this little town called Regalsville? And he's like, I live in Regalsville. And I was like, oh, okay, sweet. You know, I was like, cool. You know, I didn't even know it then. I was like, God is going here, dude. Like, here. So, and this person immediately got me going on his steps and started talking about principles and action and about God. And I'm like, whoa, God, whoa. I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't even, it wasn't something I was searching for when I came here. It wasn't something I was looking for. But it was probably the greatest gift I've ever been given, is to come to some, to get this relationship with this God that I don't even understand. I can't fathom what it is or who it is or why it even is. I just, these experiences I've had, I just know that it is. You know, and nobody can really convince me otherwise at this point. I started doing these steps. And he started talking about how we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. And he started talking about why we were unmanageable, because we start drinking, and then that compromises our thinking and compromises our ability to deal with problems, and our problems build up, and our ability to deal with the problems shrinks. And it talks about in the big book how there's on our own unaided will, we are unable to change that. And that's why we need God's help. And I was like, well, there's a problem, see, because I hate God. So I don't know what this God's going to do for me. And what this person did is, he didn't tell me what God was or anything. He just kind of assured me that if I do these things, that I will discover that God. And that's indeed what happened. All I needed to do was try. I just had to have a little bit of faith. You know, I can remember this. He said to me, if you're asking yourself, does God exist? You're asking yourself the wrong question. He said the question you need to ask yourself is, do you want God to exist? And at that point, I was like, yeah. You know what? That would be pretty cool. It'd be pretty cool, because I saw a lot of people. I came to this meeting up here. That next Monday night, and I saw a lot of people walking around talking about this God and smiling, and I'm like, yeah, man, you know, that looks pretty cool, man. God's doing stuff in their life, man. Maybe I should maybe this God thing will work, you know? And you know, what I was told was that I don't really need to understand or figure out anything. All I need to do is be willing to try to do these things that have been laid out for me. Just try to live by these principles that were set down by a bunch of guys who just basically got them and made them palatable, and they got them from, you know, a whole other set of books that has them the same principles right in there. It's like they didn't come up with this stuff. They just made it palatable to some hopeless drug addict, drunk, God-hating guy. And we're like, you know, well, maybe if you try it this way, it might work. You know, and so I started doing these things. And I made, I made this decision. And I remember sitting in this car and we talked about Corporation Earth and how I have this job. How I have this, like, this new employer. And I'm like an agent of God. And I have this purpose. And all my life, man, I was like searching for this purpose. I really didn't think I had a purpose. You know, I felt my purpose was to suffer. Like, you know, that's like Genesis, you know, you're here to suffer and toil. That's what you're here for. I'm like, okay, God, yeah, I'm toiling, okay. But he gave me this purpose. And he said, the reason you're here is to help other people. And since then, I've come to realize also that I'm here to love other people unconditionally. And what my my conception of what love was just as off the mark as what my conception of God was. I thought love was helping people do everything they needed to do and doing stuff for them. And what I've come to realize is that sometimes that's not love at all. And there's this guy, Christian Murty, and he talks about love, and he says that, you know, because they talk a lot about selfishness, self-centeredness in this book, and I was definitely suffering from that. And what Christian Murty says is this: he says if you're seeking love, if you're trying to find it, that act in itself is selfishness and self-seeking. He said, so by seeking for love, you're actually being selfish. And I'm like, okay, I've done that, no wonder. And he also goes on to say this, that genuine love can only come to you of its free will. It can only come to you. You can't search it out. And that was a huge thing for me, was coming to terms with what a healthy love is for others, the unconditional love that it talks about in the book. You know, that all these steps are designed for us to have this experience so we can learn to love people in a healthy way, effectively, in a sense. I did this list with them. Didn't have a real lot on there, but I had my family mostly. These people who did what they did to me when I was a kid, and I hated them, man. I really did. I used to think about just killing those guys. There was two of them, two brothers, and I hated them, man. 30 years later, I'm still thinking about, like, murdering these guys. I'm like, how crazy I was. And so I made this list, and I brought it to this guy, and he showed me how, because of my selfishness and self-centered, even at the age of 7, how I had a part in what happened, even then. And although at first, when he first said it, I didn't quite grasp it. But then it, like, sunk in the more he explained it, that because I wanted to be held in the center of their world, I kept going back to that. I could have easily told my parents, but I didn't. I could have easily told teachers at school, but I didn't. And that was huge for me, because my biggest fear was that you were going to find out that all these horrible things happened to me, and it was like, I was deathly afraid of what you thought of me. I mean, that was like, number one, that was my thought, was when I met somebody was, okay, what does this guy think of me? What does this girl think of me? What do I need to be? And so when we went over that, and I had that, that experience of that, you know what, I had a part in it. It's not to say that it was my fault, but I had a part in it. I had this sense of relief in that that maybe I could forgive these guys for what they did. And that was huge for me. And I was explaining to me that, when we're ready to have God remove those defects of character and we humbly ask Him that, that all that is just us trying to get rid of those things that block us off from being effectively loving other people. And my fear of what you thought of me kept me from effectively loving others for a long, long time. If I'm afraid of you, I'm certainly not going to go up and shake your hand. I'm certainly not going to talk to you. I'm certainly not going to, like, ask you if you need help. So it was really imparted onto me how important it was for me to find out through this process what keeps me from being of maximum service to you and all of God's kids. So that was a huge one, man. Resentment was gone. That fear was gone. Some of the selfishness is still there, and some of the dishonesty even. Some of those things still are with me. And it says in the book, if they aren't removed, we ask for the willingness. Until they are, until we get the willingness to have God remove them, and that's what I pray for today. When those things crop up, and I identify them, and I'm constantly praying for that I can have the willingness to remove the rest of those things, because they're not all gone. And I was also told that I am not to try to remove them; that's God's job, not my job. The biggest thing too is that He talked about how my thinking was broken, and I can't fix my thinking with broken thinking. And I'm like, dude, that's pretty profound, but how true is that, It's like having a broken down car and wanting to take the car to the auto parts store to get more parts. You can't do it. It's impossible. So we made a list of all persons I harmed, which I had already done. Because most of those people on that list I had said some pretty bad things to, or I treated pretty horribly, because I thought that I was a victim and it was all their fault, and I blamed them for a long, long time. So I made a list and started trying to amend the past. A lot of those amendments are a lifelong thing for me. I can't make up for 30 years of putting people and blaming people. I can't make up for that in like a 10-minute talk with them. So I try to do it every day by living my life in a way that I can be of maximum service to them and help them and forgive them and be tolerant of them and accepting of them. I had this other really cool amends that I did. It was on my resentment list with society. And this is like one of the coolest amends I ever did. It's And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he suggested that I volunteer somewhere. And I said, well, you know, I used to volunteer on this rescue squad way back when, before I really, really got involved in, you know, drinking and getting what I wanted, and drinking took total precedence over everything. And so I went home that night, and I called this number. I actually looked on the internet, and it turns out that the same guy who was the captain of this rescue squad is still captain today. And so I called down in the building, and they were like, oh yeah, Larry, he's still captain. And you know, they're looking for members, man. They need members bad. They need volunteers. So he's like, oh, you know, first, second, third Wednesdays, still drill nights, meetings, you know. And I'm like, cool. And he's like, but today's the fourth Wednesday, so there's nothing going on tonight. He's like, but I'll leave your name and number, and they can give you a call. So I went down to this Frenchtown meeting Wednesday nights at 7:30, and the speaker just happened to go into these convulsions like 10 minutes into his talk, and he started like fell on the floor and started seizing. And I'm like, oh, man, if I like, geez, I would know what to do. If I was still in a rescue squad, I'd know what to do, you know. I'd at least be able to try to help this guy. So meeting kind of ran out, and we're out in the parking lot till like almost 9 o'clock talking, and to the sponsee that I have that goes to that meeting a lot. And so on my way home, I'm like, you know, I need some food. I'm like, you don't want to go. There's only like a Chinese place and a pizza place between this meeting and my house. And I'm like, I didn't feel like pizza because I've been eating at pizza places for like ever. And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to get some Chinese food. And I actually drove past this Chinese place, and I saw the open sign. It was like almost 9:15 on a Wednesday night in the middle of nowhere. I live in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to go there. And I turn around, and I come back up the road, and I pull in, and there's like one other truck there. I didn't really think anything of it. And I walk in, and there, standing at the counter, is this guy, Larry, who is the captain of the rescue squad. There he is, right there, standing there. And I'm like, man, I'm like, I was just talking about you today. I'm like, it was like amazing. It was like this total God thing, man. It was like God was going, dude, here, can it be any more blatant than this? And so that's what I did. I went back and I started joining that rescue squad, and I started trying to pay back society, trying to pay back and trying to show up and help people. And, you know, and I never know when that's going to happen. Last night, me and Dave had a little incident where we show up at the diner, and we're walking in, and there's this couple and their son. And they were walking in a little bit before us, and on the way out, as we're walking by, they were turned around and started walking to the car. And she's like, nah, he's got asthma, he doesn't feel good, we're going to take him home. And we're like, kind of didn't even get in the diner, and we kind of turned around, and the guy really started, like, really having trouble breathing. And Dave's like, dude, should we do anything? I'm like, all right, let's go see what the deal is. And I walk over, and my wife is like, he can't breathe. And he's like, I can't breathe. And I'm like, all right. I'm like, you know, God provides us what we need. If we just show up and do what we need to do, God provides us everything we need. God provides us a tool. And I just happened to have an oxygen tank in my truck. And I pulled it out and gave this dude oxygen. The cop just happened to be going by, pulling out of the diner where he was just parked. Just, I mean, right there. Like, who would have thought, man? There's like right there. And so we flagged him down. He called an ambulance, and this guy got what he needed, you know, and had they took him up to the hospital. But it's like so amazing how, like, you know, I'm just amazed at how little I really need to know, or how little I really need to. I don't want to say do, because there's a lot to do, but how, I don't know, it's just like, how simple it is when you show up, because you can't help anybody if you don't show up. So, like, you know, the whole, like, don't drink and go to meetings, that has its validity in that, yeah, if you're not sober, you can't help another person achieve sobriety. But, you know, but there's so much more to that, you know? That acceptance thing, man, just like, you know, one of the speakers that I really like from Boston, and he says this, he's like, yeah, just don't drink no matter what. And I'm going to use this because he's not here, and I'm making my own. He said, don't drink no matter what. Yeah, that's important. But he also says, but then just forgive no matter what. Just accept people no matter what. Just love no matter what. And that was just like the coolest thing that I had ever heard. But, I got off a tangent on the men's thing, but it's been some of the best amends I've ever made. You know, it's awesome to be able to go to these people who are in their moment, they're desperate in need, and to be able to be there for them. And I would never, if I was drinking, I would have never been able to do that, ever. Ever. I wouldn't have wanted to, A, and I wouldn't have been available to, B. And, you know, the 10, 11, 12 deal, it's, you know, that constant checking up on myself, and I do find myself talking to people that I'm walking shoulder to shoulder with down this path, and when those things crop up, I do try to the best of my willingness to tell people and admit to God, ask God to help me, and, you know, immediately turn my thoughts to who else I can help. You know, the prayer meditation thing, I don't do that perfect either. You know, my prayers are pretty simple. In the morning, God, direct my thinking, guide my heart. Use me as you see fit. Put somebody in my life that I can help today. And that's pretty much the extent of my prayer in the morning. It's real simple. Sometimes if I'm really, really out of it, I'll do like read a third step prayer. But for the most part, it's pretty simple. And then at the end of the night, man, I'm like constantly thanking God for all these opportunities that he's given me and all the tools he gives me to do his will, which is help other people, love other people unconditionally. And I can't stress that enough. Like this whole program, you know, Dr. Bob said it, talks about love and service. And for me, man, it is, you know, they used to say in back in the day, Sam Shoemaker said, he's like, if you can live your life according to 1 Corinthians 13, and Henry Drummond talks about it in The Greatest Thing in the World. If you can live in that, he said, all these principles happen by default. They just happen. But you have to be willing to do that. And it's an awesome way to live. I'm going over time, man. But I can't stress it enough, man, that it is, I have this love in my heart for people today that I did not have 2 years ago. Didn't have it. Wasn't there. You know, and it's just the most amazing thing to show up and smile and see all these smiling people and be able to do this. You know, again, I would have never thought in a million years that I'd be up here talking about God and what God has done for me. Because I really believe that God didn't want anything to do with me, man. He's like, yeah, that's a bad seed. Just kind of get him off the side. But I want to thank you guys for letting me up here, and that's all I got. Thanks.